Bring the rest of my property up here.
Pris ordered J.R. Isidore.
In particular, I want the TV set, so we can hear Buster's announcement.
Yes.
Irmgard Batty agreed.
We need the TV. We've been waiting a long time for tonight.
My own set gets the government channel, Isidore said. Off in the corner of the living room, Roy Batty belched. It's Buster Friendly and his friendly friends that we want to watch, Iz. Or do you want me to call you J.R.? Anyhow, do you understand? So will you go get the set? Alone, Isidore made his way down the echoing, empty hall to the stairs. The potent, strong fragrance of happiness still bloomed in him. The sense of being, for the first time in his dull life, useful. He entered Pris's former apartment. The silence all at once penetrated. You have to be with other people, he thought, in order to live at all. Thank God they stayed. It would require two trips to transfer Pris's possessions to the apartment above. A few minutes later, he had gotten the TV upstairs. His fingers groaning, he placed it on the coffee table in the living room. The Batties and Pris watched impassively. Downstairs again, he gathered the girls' clothing together, stuffed every piece into the suitcase, then labored back up the stairs. On the step ahead of him, something small moved in the dust. Instantly, he dropped the suitcases. He whipped out a plastic medicine bottle, which, like everyone else, he carried for just this. A spider, undistinguished but alive. Shakily, he eased it into the bottle and snapped the cap shut. Upstairs at the door of his apartment, he paused to get his breath. Yes, sir, folks, the time is now. This is Buster Friendly, who hopes and trusts you're as eager as I am to share the discovery which I've made, and by the way, had verified by top-trained research workers. Ho-ho, folks, this is it. I found a spider, John Isidore said. The three androids glanced up.
Let's see it,
Pris said. Don't talk while Buster is on, Roy Batty said.
I've never seen a spider,
Pris said.
All those legs. Why does it need so many legs, J.R.?
That's the way spiders are, Isidore said, his heart pounding. 8 legs.
You know what I think?
Pris said.
I think it doesn't need all those legs. 8?
Irmgard Batty said.
Why couldn't it get by on 4? Cut 4 off and see.
Opening her purse, she produced a pair of clean, sharp cuticle scissors, which she passed to Pris. A weird terror struck at J.R. Isidore. Carrying the medicine bottle into the kitchen, Pris seated herself at J.R. Isidore's breakfast table. She removed the lid from the bottle and dumped the spider out. She reached for the scissors. Please, Isidore said. Pris glanced up.
Is it worth something?
Don't mutilate it, he said. With the scissors, Pris snipped off one of the spider's legs. In the living room, Buster Friendly on the TV screen said,
Take a look at this enlargement of a section of background. This is the sky that you usually see. Wait, I'll have Earl Parameter, head of my research staff, explain their virtually world-shaking discovery to you.
Pris clipped off another leg, restraining the spider with the edge of her hand. She was smiling.
Blow-ups of the video pictures, a new voice from the TV said, when subjected to rigorous laboratory scrutiny, reveal that the gray backdrop of sky and daytime moon against which Mercer moves is not only not Terran, it is artificial.
You're missing it,
Irmgard called to Pris.
This is so important, what they're saying. It proves everything we believed is true.
The TV set continued.
The moon is painted. In the enlargements, one of which you can now see on the screen, brushstrokes are shown. And there is even some evidence that the scraggly weeds, perhaps even the stones hurled at Mercer by unseen alleged parties, are equally fake. It is quite possible, in fact, that the stones are of a soft plastic, causing no authentic wounds.
In other words, Buster Friendly broke in, Wilbur Mercer is not suffering at all.
We at last managed, Mr. Friendly, to track down a former Hollywood special effects man, Wade Cortot, who flatly states, from his years of experience, that the figure of Mercer could well be merely some bit player marching across a soundstage. Pris had now cut off 3 legs from the spider, which crept about miserably on the kitchen table. Quite frankly, we believed Cortot, and we spent a good deal of time examining publicity pictures of bit players once employed by the now-defunct Hollywood movie industry. And you found?
Listen to this,
Roy Batty said. Irmgard gazed fixedly at the TV, and Pris ceased her mutilation of the spider. We located, by means of thousands upon thousands of photographs, a very old man now, named Al Jari, who played a number of bit parts in pre-war films. From our lab, we sent a team to Jari's home in East Harmony, Indiana. I'll let one of the members of the team describe what he found.
A technician spoke.
I scanned, by telepathic means, the blurred, debris-cluttered, and hazy mind of Al Jari, seated across from me. I found that the old man did, in actuality, make a series of short 15-minute video films for an employee whom he'd never seen. And as we had theorized, the rocks did consist of a rubber-like plastic. The bloodshed was ketchup.
Al Jari, Buster Friendly said.
Well, well, an old man who even in his prime never amounted to anything. It has often been said by the adherents of Mercerism that Wilbur Mercer is not a human being, that he is an archetypal superior entity, perhaps from another star. Well, in a sense, this contention has proven correct. Wilbur Mercer is not human, does not in fact exist. The world in which he climbs is a cheap Hollywood soundstage which vanished into kipple years ago. And who, then, has spawned this hoax on the soul system? Think about that for a time, folks.
We may never know,
Irmgard murmured. We may never know, Buster Friendly said. Nor can we fathom the peculiar purpose behind this swindle. Yes, folks, swindle. Mercerism is a swindle.
It's that empathy,
Irmgard said. She roved into the kitchen, up to Isidore.
Isn't it a way of proving that humans can do something we can't do? Because without the Mercer experience, we just have your word that you feel this empathy business, this shared group thing. How's the spider?
She bent over Pris's shoulder. With the scissors, Pris snipped off another of the spider's legs.
For now,
she said. She nudged the spider.
He won't go, but he can.
Roy Batty appeared at the doorway.
It's done. Buster said it out loud. And nearly every human in the system heard him. Mercerism is a swindle. The whole experience of empathy is a swindle.
I don't think this will end the cult of Mercer,
Pris said.
But right this minute there are a lot of unhappy human beings. We've waited for months. We all knew it was coming, this pitch of Buster's. Well, why not? Buster is one of us. An android,
Irmgard explained.
And nobody knows. No humans, I mean.
Pris, with the scissors, cut yet another leg from the spider. All at once, John Isidore pushed her away and lifted up the mutilated creature. He carried it to the sink, and there he drowned it. In his mind, his hopes drowned too, as swiftly as the spider.
He's really upset,
Irmgard said.
Don't look like that, J.R.
It's all over now, Iz,
Roy Batty said. For Mercerism, I mean. With his nails, he managed to lift the corpse of the spider from the sink.
Maybe this was the last spider, he said. The last living spider on Earth.
I don't feel well, Isidore said. Is the sky behind Mercer just painted? Not real?
You saw the enlargements on TV,
Roy Batty said.
The brushstrokes.
Mercerism isn't finished, Isidore said. Something ailed the 3 androids. Something terrible. The spider, he thought. Maybe it had been the last spider on Earth. And the spider is gone. Mercer is gone. He saw the dust and the ruin of the apartment as it lay spreading out everywhere. He heard the kipple coming. The final disorder of all forms. The absence which would win out. Reaching out, he touched the wall. His hand broke the surface. Gray particles trickled and hurried down, fragments of plaster resembling the radioactive dust outside. He seated himself at the table. Like rotten, hollow tubes, the legs of the chair bent. Standing quickly, he tried to reform the chair. The chair came apart in his hands.
What's he doing?
Ermgard Batty's voice came up to him.
He's breaking everything. Isidore, stop.
I'm not doing it, he said. He walked unsteadily into the living room, to be by himself. He stood by the tattered couch. He thought of the corpse of the spider with its four remaining legs. Everything in here is old, he realized. It long ago began to decay, and it won't stop. The corpse of the spider has taken over. In the depression caused by the sagging of the floor, pieces of animals manifested themselves. The head of a crow, mummified hands which might have once been parts of monkeys. Again, he thought, it's happening to me again. I will be down here a long time, he realized, as before. A dry wind rustled, and around him the heaps of bones broke. Even the wind destroys them, he perceived. At this stage, just before time ceases, I wish I could remember how to climb up from here. Looking up, he saw nothing to grasp. Mercer, where are you now? This is the tomb world, and I am in it again, but this time you're not here. Something crept across his foot. The mutilated spider. He picked it up and held it in the palm of his hand. The bones, he realized, have reversed themselves. The spider is again alive. Mercer must be near. The wind blew, cracking and splintering the remaining bones, but he sensed the presence of Mercer. Come here, he said to Mercer. Across the landscape, weeds advanced. Weeds corkscrewed their way into the walls around him and worked into the walls until the weeds became their own spore. The spore expanded, split, and burst within the corrupted steel and shards of concrete that had formerly been walls. But the desolation remained after the walls had gone. Except for the frail, dim figure of Mercer, the old man faced him. Is the sky painted? Isidore asked. Are there really brushstrokes that show up under magnification? Yes, Mercer said. I can't see them. You're too close. You have to be a long way off, the way the androids are. They have better perspective. Is that why they claim you're a fraud? I am a fraud. They are sincere. Their research is genuine. From their standpoint, I am an elderly, retired bit player named Al Jarry. All of it is true. They will have trouble understanding why nothing has changed. Mercer indicated with a sweep of his hand the barren, rising hillside, the familiar place. I lifted you from the tomb world just now, and I will continue to lift you until you lose interest and want to quit. But you will have to stop searching for me, because I will never stop searching for you. Mercer held out a closed hand, palm up. Before I forget it, I have something of yours here. He opened his fingers. On the hand rested the mutilated spider, but with its snipped-off legs restored. Thanks. Isidore accepted the spider. He started to say something further. An alarm bell clanged. Roy Batty snarled. There's a bounty hunter in the building. Get all the lights off. Get him away from the empathy box. He has to be ready at the door. Go on. Move him. Looking down, John Isidore saw his own hands. They gripped the twin handles of the empathy box. As he stood gaping at them, the lights in the living room of his apartment plunged out.
Listen, J.R.,
Ermgard whispered.
You have to go to the door when he knocks. You have to show him your identification and tell him this is your apartment and no one else is here. Don't let him in,
Pris said.
Say anything, do anything that will stop him.
Isidore groped his way to the door, halted there, listening. Hear anything? Roy Batty said, bending close. Step out and take a look. Opening the door, Isidore looked up and down the hall. He still held the spider Mercer had given him. Was it actually the spider Pris had snipped apart? Probably not, but anyhow, it was alive. It crept about within his closed hand. He reached the end of the hall, descended the stairs, and stepped outside, onto what had once been a terraced path. The garden had perished during the war, and the path had ruptured in 1,000 places. But he knew its surface, and he followed it, coming at last to a yard-square patch of dust-saturated, drooping weeds. There he deposited the spider. It departed his hand. A flashlight beam focused on the weeds. Now he could see the spider. It rested on a serrated leaf. What did you do? The man holding the flashlight asked.
I put down a spider, he said, so it could get away.
Why don't you take it up to your apartment? You ought to keep it in a jar. According to the January Sydneys, most spiders are up 10% in retail price. You could have gotten $100 and some odd for it.
If I took it back up there, she'd cut it apart again, Isidore said, bit by bit, to see what it did.
Androids do that, the man said. Reaching into his overcoat, he brought out something which flapped open and extended toward Isidore. I'm an investigator for the San Francisco Police Department. Deckard, Rick Deckard. The man flipped his ID shut again. They're up there now? The three?
Well, the thing is, I'm looking after them. Two were women. They're the last ones of the group. The rest are dead. I brought Pris's TV set up from her apartment and put it in mine so they could watch Buster Friendly. Buster proved beyond a doubt that Mercer doesn't exist.
Isidore felt excitement, knowing something of this importance, news that the bounty hunter evidently hadn't heard. Let's go up there, Deckard said. Suddenly he held a laser tube pointed at Isidore. Then, indecisively, he put it away. You're a special, aren't you? He said. A chicken head.
But I have a job. I drive a truck for the Van Ness Pet Hospital, owned by Hannibal Sloat.
Will you take me up there and show me which apartment they're in? There are over 1,000 separate apartments. You can save me a lot of time.
If you kill them, you won't be able to fuse with Mercer again, Isidore said.
You won't take me up there? Just tell me the floor. I'll figure out which apartment it is.
No, Isidore said.
Under state and federal law, Deckard began. He ceased then. Good night, he said, and walked away, up the path and into the building, his flashlight bleeding a yellowed, diffuse path before him. Inside the Conapt building, Rick Deckard shut off his flashlight. He made his way along the hall, thinking, one of them will be a duplicate of Rachel. Maybe the special has been living with her. I wonder how he liked it. He had brought listening gear from his car. He set it up now, a revolving D-Tech snout with a blip screen. In the silence of the hall, the screen indicated nothing. Not on this floor, he said to himself. He clicked over to vertical. On that axis, the snout absorbed a faint signal. Upstairs. He gathered up the gear and his briefcase and climbed the stairs to the next floor. A figure in the shadows waited. If you move, I'll retire you, Rick said. The male one, waiting for him. I'm not an android, the figure said. My name is Mercer. It stepped into a zone of light. I inhabit this building because of Mr. Isidore, the special who had the spider. You talked to him briefly outside. Am I outside Mercerism now? Rick said. As the chicken head said, because of what I'm going to do in the next few minutes? Mr. Isidore spoke for himself, not for me. What you are doing has to be done. Raising his arm, he pointed at the stairs behind Rick. I came to tell you that one of them is the hard one of the three, and you must retire it first. Quick, Mr. Deckard, on the steps! His laser tube thrust out. Rick spun and sank onto his haunches facing the flight of stairs. Up it glided a woman, toward him, and he knew her. Rachel, he said, perplexed, and then he saw that it was not quite Rachel.
For what we've meant to each other,
the android said as it approached him, its arms reaching out as if to clutch at him. The clothes, he thought, are wrong, but the eyes, the same eyes, and there are more like this, each with its own name, but all Rachel Rosen, Rachel, the prototype, used by the manufacturer to protect the others. He fired at her as, imploringly, she dashed toward him. The android burst and parts of it flew. He covered his face and looked again, looked and saw the laser tube it had carried roll away, back onto the stairs. The hard one of the three, Mercer had said. He peered about, searching for Mercer. The old man had gone. He stood alone in the empty hall, but elsewhere in the building, the Batties waited and knew. He hurried down the hall, and all at once his detection gear registered the presence of cephalic activity. He had found their apartment. He rapped on the door. From within, a man's voice sounded.
Who is it?
This is Mr. Isidore, Rick said. Let me in because I'm looking after you, and two of you are women.
We are not opening the door,
a woman's voice came. I want to watch Buster Friendly on Pris's TV set, Rick said. Now that he's proved Mercer doesn't exist, it's very important to watch him. I drive a truck for the Van Ness Pet Hospital, which is owned by Mr. Hannibal Sloat. Would you open the door? It's my apartment. He waited, and the door opened. Within the apartment, he saw darkness and indistinct shapes, two of them.
You have to administer tests.
The smaller shape, the woman, said. It's too late, Rick said. The taller figure tried to push the door shut and turn on some electronic equipment. No, Rick said. I have to come in. He let Roy Batty fire once. You've lost your legal basis, Rick said, by firing on me. You should have forced me to give you the void conf test, but now it doesn't matter. Once more, Roy Batty sent a laser beam cutting at him, missed, dropped the tube, and ran somewhere deeper inside the apartment.
Why didn't Pris get you?
Mrs. Batty said. There is no Pris, he said. Only Rachel Rosen, over and over again. He saw the laser tube in her dimly outlined hand. Roy Batty had slipped it to her, had meant to decoy him into the apartment, far in, so that Irmgard Batty could get him from behind, in the back. I'm sorry, Mrs. Batty, Rick said, and shot her. Roy Batty, in the other room, let out a cry of anguish. Okay, you loved her, Rick said, and I loved Rachel. He shot Roy Batty. The big man's corpse smashed into the kitchen table and carried dishes and flatware down with it. Reflex circuits in the corpse made it twitch and flutter, but it had died. Rick ignored it, not seeing it and not seeing that of Irmgard Batty by the front door. I got the last one, Rick realized. Six today, almost a record. And now it's over, and I can go home, back to Iran and the goat, and we'll have enough money for once. He sat down on the couch, and presently, as he sat there in the silence, the special, Mr. Isidore, appeared at the door. Better not look, Rick said.
I saw her on the stairs. Pris.
Don't take it so hard, Rick said. Where's your phone? The special said nothing, did nothing except stand, so Rick hunted for the phone himself and dialed Harry Bryant's office. When he got back to his own apartment building, Iran met him on the roof. She looked at him in a deranged, peculiar way. Anyhow, it's over, he said, putting his arm around her. And I've been thinking, maybe Harry Bryant can assign me to...
Rick, I have to tell you something. Sorry. The goat is dead.
For some reason, it did not surprise him. It only made him feel worse. I think there's a guarantee in the contract, he said. If it gets sick within...
It didn't get sick. Someone came here, got the goat out of its cage, and dragged it to the edge of the roof.
And pushed it off?
Yes.
Did you see who did it?
I saw her very clearly. Barbara was up here. He came down to get me, and we called the police, but by then the animal was dead and she had left. A small, young-looking girl with dark hair and large black eyes, very thin, wearing a long fish-scale coat. She made no effort to keep us from seeing her, as if she didn't care.
No, she didn't care. Rachel wouldn't have given a damn if you saw her. She probably wanted you to, so I'd know who had done it. He kissed her. You've been waiting up here all this time?
Only for a half an hour. That's when it happened. Half an hour ago.
Iran gently kissed him back.
It's so awful.
He turned toward his parked car, opened the door, and got behind the wheel.
Where are you going? Won't you come downstairs and be with me? There was the most shocking news on TV. Buster Friendly claims that Mercer is a fake. What do you think about that, Rick? Do you think it could be true?
Everything is true. Everything anybody has ever thought.
Will you be all right?
I'll be all right, he said and thought. And I am going to die. Both those are true, too. He closed the car door, flicked a signal with his hand to Iran, and then swept up into the night sky. Once, he thought, I would have seen the stars, years ago, but now it's only the dust. No one has seen a star in years, at least not from Earth. Maybe I'll go where I can see stars, he said to himself as the car headed away from San Francisco, toward the uninhabited desolation to the north, to the place where no living thing would go, not unless it felt that the end had come. In the early morning light, the land below him extended seemingly forever, gray and refuse-littered. Once, he thought, crops grew here, and animals grazed. He brought the hover car down, coasted above the surface. What would Dave Holden say about me now? He asked himself. In one sense, I'm now the greatest bounty hunter who ever lived. I ought to call him. He clicked off the ignition, glided for an interval, and then set the hover car down. Picking up the receiver of the car's phone, he dialed San Francisco.
Mount Zion Hospital.
You have a patient named Dave Holden. Would it be possible for me to talk to him?
Just a moment and I'll check on that, sir.
Time passed. Rick took a pinch of Dr. Johnson's snuff and shivered. Without the car's heater, the temperature had begun to plunge.
No, sir,
the operator said.
Dr. Costa says that Mr. Holden is not receiving calls.
This is police business. He held his ID up.
Just a moment. No, sir. Dr. Costa does not feel Mr. Holden's condition will permit him to take any calls.
Okay, Rick said. He hung up. The car had become too cold now, so he opened the door and stepped out. A noxious, unexpected wind filtered through his clothes and he began to walk. It would have been rewarding to talk to Dave, he decided. Dave would have approved of what I did. But also he would have understood the other part, which I don't think even Mercer comprehends. For Mercer, everything is easy, he thought, because Mercer accepts everything. Nothing is alien to him. But what I've done, that's become alien to me. He walked on, up the hillside, and with each step the weight on him grew. As he plodded along, a vague and almost hallucinatory pall hazed over his mind. Here the dead stones, the dust-stricken weeds, perceived nothing. At that moment, the first rock, and it was not rubber or soft foam plastic, struck him in the inguinal region. And the pain, the first knowledge of absolute isolation and suffering, touched him throughout. He halted, and then, goaded on, the goad invisible but real, not to be challenged, he resumed his climb. Mercer? He stopped, stood still. In front of him, a shadowy figure, motionless. Wilbur Mercer? Is that you? My God, he realized. It's my shadow. I have to get out of here. Down, off of this hill. He scrambled back down. Once, he fell. Clouds of dust obscured everything, and he ran. Ahead, he saw his parked car. He plucked open the car door, squeezed inside. Who threw that stone at me? He asked himself. No one. But why does it bother me? I've undergone it before, during fusion. This isn't new. But it was, because, he thought, I did it alone. This was the last place to go, he realized. I shouldn't have flown here, and now he found himself too tired to fly back out. He looked at his watch, 9:30. Picking up the vidphone receiver, he dialed the Hall of Justice on Lombard. Let me speak to Inspector Bryant.
Inspector Bryant is not in his office, Mr. Deckard. He's out of his car, but I don't get any answer.
Let me talk to my secretary. A moment later, the orange face of Anne Marston appeared on the screen.
Oh, Mr. Deckard, Inspector Bryant has been trying to get a hold of you. I think he's turning your name over to Chief Cutter for a citation. You know, because you retired those six...
I know what I did, he said.
That's never happened before. Oh, and Mr. Deckard, your wife phoned. She wants to know if you're all right.
Miss Marston peered at him intently.
Mr. Deckard, you look awful. So tired. And God, your cheek is bleeding.
Putting his hand up, he felt the blood. From a rock, probably. More than one, evidently, had struck him.
You look,
Miss Marston said,
like Wilbur Mercer.
I am. I'm Wilbur Mercer. I've permanently fused with him, and I'm sitting here waiting to unfuse somewhere near the Oregon border.
Shall we send someone out? A department car to pick you up?
No. I'm no longer with the department.
Obviously you did too much yesterday, Mr. Deckard. What you need now is bed rest. Call your wife right away, Mr. Deckard, because she's terribly, terribly worried. I could tell. You're both in dreadful shape.
It's because of my goat. Not the androids. Rachel was wrong. I didn't have any trouble retiring them. And the special was wrong, too, about my not being able to fuse with Mercer again. The only one who was right is Mercer.
You better get back here to the Bay Area, Mr. Deckard, where there are people.
It's strange, Rick said. I had the absolute, utter, completely real illusion that I had become Mercer. When you use the empathy box, you feel you're with Mercer. The difference is, I wasn't with anyone. I was alone.
They're saying now that Mercer is a fake?
Mercer isn't a fake, unless reality is a fake. This hill, he thought, the dust in these many stones, each one different from all the others. I'm afraid, he said, that I can't stop being Mercer. Once you start, it's too late to back off. Will I have to climb the hill again, he wondered, forever, as Mercer does, trapped by eternity. Goodbye, he said, and started to ring off.
You'll call your wife, you promise?
Yes, thanks, Anne. He hung up. Bed rest. The last time I hit the bed was with Rachel. She must be back in Seattle now. I wish I could do to Rachel what she did to me, but it can't be done to an android because they don't care. If I had killed you last night, my goat would be alive now. Once more, he picked up the phone to call his wife, and froze. He set the receiver back down and did not take his eyes from the spot that had moved outside the car. The bulge in the ground, among the stones. An animal. I know what it is. I've never seen one before, but I know from the old nature films they show on government TV. They're extinct. Swiftly, he dragged out his much-creased Sydneys and read, Toad. All varieties extinct. The critter most precious to Wilbur Mercer, along with the donkey. But toads most of all. I need a box. He leaped out, hurried to the trunk compartment, unlocked and opened it. There rested a cardboard container. Inside it, a spare fuel pump for his car. He dumped the fuel pump out, found some twine, and walked slowly toward the toad, not taking his eyes from it. The toad, he saw, blended in totally with the texture and shade of the ever-present dust. Had it not moved, he would have never spotted it. Yet he had been sitting no more than 2 yards from it. Did Mercer arrange it? But I'm Mercer. I arranged it. I found the toad. Found it because I see through Mercer's eyes. He squatted on his haunches, close beside the toad. It had shoved aside the grit to make a partial hole for itself, so that only the top of its flat skull and its eyes projected above the ground. Meanwhile, its metabolism slowed almost to a halt. It had drifted off into a trance. Setting the cardboard box down, he carefully began brushing the loose soil away from the toad. It did not seem to object, but of course it was not aware of his existence. When he lifted the toad out, he felt its peculiar coolness. Now the toad squirmed. A big one, he thought. I wonder where it finds the water for its eggs. So this is what Mercer sees, he thought, as he tied the cardboard box shut, tied it again and again. Life which we can no longer distinguish. Life carefully buried up to its forehead in the carcass of a dead world. In every cinder of the universe, Mercer probably perceives inconspicuous life. Now I know, he thought. And once having seen through Mercer's eyes, I probably will never stop. And no android, he thought, will cut the legs from this, as they did from the chicken-head spider. At the Penfield Mood Organ, Iran Deckard sat with her right index finger touching the numbered dial. But she did not dial. She felt too listless and ill to want anything. She wondered again where Rick had gone. He may be coming back, and on the other hand, he may not be, she said to herself. A knock sounded. She ran to the door. There he stood, a cut on his cheek, his clothes wrinkled and gray. Dust clung to every part of him, except his eyes. Round with awe his eyes shone, like those of a little boy. It's nice to see you, he said. I have something. He held a cardboard box with both hands. When he entered the apartment, he did not set it down, as if, she thought, it contained something too fragile and too valuable to let go of.
I'll fix you a cup of coffee.
At the stove, she pressed the coffee button, and in a moment had put the mug by his place at the kitchen table. Still holding the box, he seated himself, and on his face the round-eyed wonder remained. In all the years that she had known him, she had not encountered this expression before. I'm going to sleep, he announced. All day. I phoned in and got Harry Bryant. He said take the day off and rest, which is exactly what I'm going to do. Carefully, he set the box down on the table and picked up his coffee mug. Dutifully, because she wanted him to, he drank his coffee.
What do you have in the box, Rick?
She said. A toad.
Can I see it?
She watched as he untied the box and removed the lid.
Oh. Will it bite?
Pick it up. It won't bite. Toads don't have teeth. Rick lifted the toad out and extended it toward her.
I thought toads were extinct,
she said as she turned it over, curious about its legs. They seemed almost useless.
Can toads jump like frogs? I mean, will it jump out of my hands suddenly?
The legs of toads are weak, Rick said. That's the main difference between a toad and a frog, that and water. A frog remains near water, but a toad can live in the desert. I found this in the desert, up near the Oregon border, where everything had died. He reached to take it back, but she had discovered something. Still holding it upside down, she poked at its abdomen and then, with her nail, located the tiny control panel. She flipped the panel open. His face fell by degrees. Crestfallen, he gazed mutely at the false animal. He took it back from her. He did not seem quite to understand. He then carefully replaced it in its box. I wonder how it got out there in the desolate part of California like that. Somebody must have put it there. No way to tell what for.
Maybe I shouldn't have told you about it being electrical.
No. I'm glad to know. Or rather, I'd prefer to know.
Do you want to use the mood organ to feel better? You always have gotten a lot out of it, more than I ever have.
I'll be okay. He shook his head, as if trying to clear it, still bewildered. The spider Mercer gave the chicken head, Isidore. It probably was artificial, too. But it doesn't matter. The electric things have their lives, too, paltry as those lives are.
You look as though you've walked 100 miles.
It's been a long day. He nodded.
Go get into bed and sleep.
He stared at her then, as if perplexed. It's over, isn't it?
It's over.
God, what a marathon assignment. Once I began, there wasn't any way for me to stop. You were right this morning when you said I'm nothing but a crude cop with crude cop hands.
I don't feel that anymore. I'm just damn glad to have you come back home where you ought to be.
She kissed him, and that seemed to please him. His face lit up. Almost as much as before, before she had shown him that the toad was electric. Did you think I did wrong? He asked. What I did today?
No.
Mercer said it was wrong, but I should do it anyhow. It's really weird. Sometimes it's better to do something wrong than right.
It's the curse on us,
Iran said,
that Mercer talks about.
The dust? He asked.
The killers that found Mercer in his 16th year, when they told him he couldn't reverse time and bring things back to life again. So now all he can do is move along with life, going where it goes to death. And the killers throw the rocks. It's they who are doing it, still pursuing him. And all of us, actually. Did one of them cut your cheek where it's been bleeding?
Yes.
Will you go to bed now, if I set the mood organ to a 670 setting?
What does that bring about? He asked.
Long-deserved peace.
He got to his feet, stood painfully, drowsy and confused, and then, by degrees, he progressed to the bedroom. Okay, he said. Long-deserved peace. He stretched out on the bed, dust sifting from his clothes and hair onto the white sheets. No need to turn on the mood organ, Iran realized as she pressed the button, which made the windows of the bedroom opaque. The gray light of day disappeared. On the bed, Rick, after a moment, slept. She stayed there for a time, keeping him in sight to be sure he wouldn't wake up, wouldn't spring up to a sitting position in fear as he sometimes did at night. And then, presently, she returned to the kitchen, reseated herself at the kitchen table. Next to her, the electric toad flopped and rustled in its box. She wondered what it ate and what repairs on it would run. Opening the phone book, she looked in the yellow pages under Animal Accessories, Electric, and Dialed.
I'd like to order 1 pound of artificial flies that really fly around and buzz, please.
Is it for an electric turtle, ma'am?
A toad.
Oh, well, then I suggest our mixed assortment of artificial crawling and flying bugs of all types, including...
The flies will do. Will you deliver? I don't want to leave my apartment. My husband's asleep, and I want to be sure he's all right.
For a toad, the clerk said, I'd suggest also a perpetually renewing puddle, unless it's a horned toad, in which case there's a kit containing sand, multicolored pebbles, and bits of organic debris. And if you're going to be putting it through a feed cycle regularly, I'd suggest you let our service department make a periodic tongue adjustment. In a toad, that's vital.
Fine. I want it to work perfectly. My husband is devoted to it.
She gave her address and hung up. And feeling better, fixed herself at last a cup of coffee.
This has been a Time Warner Audiobooks production of Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? Written by Philip K. Dick. Read for you by Matthew Modine with Calista Flockhart. Produced and directed by Maya Thomas. Text abridged by Jeffrey Gorney and edited by John Whitman. Tape edited by Gordon Hukilo and Mark Waldrop. Mixed and mastered by Mark Waldrop. Music composed and produced by Jerry Carriaga.